Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. It's a packed one and a powerful one, so buckle up and we'll get going. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Jesse Kimbrough Marshall, a public health doctor and medical doctor in Detroit, Michigan. And we're going to be talking about the impact of the novel coronavirus on the Black community. Before that, we'll talk with Rigotis Appling, a public defender in New York City, about her recent article, Social Distancing Doesn't Matter When It Comes to Racism and Aggressive Policing. Now, many of you who are regular listeners know that my show originates in Los Angeles, and it's recorded live in a radio station studio. However, in the times of the coronavirus pandemic, I've been doing it basically on my laptop at home, and there have been some technical challenges, as well as occasional sounds of dogs barking in the background. I trust that you will bear with me. Because of technical difficulties, I'm unable to bring you an interview I did with some folks from the RefuseFascism.org about the growing actions of fascist organizations in many states and the need to resist. So I'm opening the show up with two short segments. We'll be hearing a very relevant excerpt from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from a talk he gave a couple of years ago, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go, In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible. This talk is even more relevant today when so many people are upset and afraid of what they see coming, but actually don't understand the grave danger posed by the Trump-Pence regime and the need for people to stand up and step out. So we're going to hear what has given rise to the situation in which we have a fascist regime ruling the U.S. But right now I want to read something to mark a very important anniversary. May 4th and May 15th are the anniversaries of two massacres on college campuses 50 years ago. May 4th is the anniversary of Kent State, where 11 students were wounded and 4 were killed by soldiers from the Ohio National Guard. May 15th marks the anniversary of Jackson State, where 2 students at a predominantly African-American university were shot and killed by state police. Now this is from revcom.us. May 1970 was a time when students were not complacent, passive, and complicit, but dared, even at the cost of very real sacrifice, to stand up against and resist the crimes of their government and the system that government serves and enforces. And there are very important lessons from this inspiring experience for today. It's time, once again, for students and many others to step up and join the movement for an actual revolution. Here, Bob Avakian talks about the 1960s. Between the anti-war protesters and the war planners in the Pentagon, between the Black Panthers and J. Edgar Hoover, between Black, Latino, Asian, and Native peoples on the one side and the government on the other, between the women who rebelled against their traditional roles and the rich old men who ruled the country, between the youth who brought forward new music in the broadest sense and the preachers who denounced them as disciples of the devil and despoilers of civilization, the battle lines were sharply drawn. And through the course of those tumultuous times, those who were rebelling against the established order and the dominating relations and traditions increasingly found common cause and powerful unity. They increasingly gained and deserved the moral as well as political initiative, while the ruling class dug in and lashed out to defend its rule, but increasingly and very deservedly lost moral and political authority. That's from the book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. You can read more about Kent State and Jackson State at revcom.us. But right now, I want to play the powerful song Ohio, written and recorded by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young within days of the massacre. And it was, I just have to tell you, it was a piece of beautiful work that lit up a generation, that made us come together and feel not just the pain of what happened, but the determination and the desire to keep on stepping up against this rotten, human-eating system. And so I think it's really appropriate that today, as we head into some very terrible situations on the world front, led by what's happening with this regime here, I think it's a really good thing to be hearing this song right now. Thank you. So we're going to hear what has given rise to the situation in which we have a fascist regime ruling the U.S.
And here is the shorter story, the more particular reasons why things have come to this crossroads in this country with potentially disastrous consequences for human beings everywhere. The USA is a country which established its territory and built the foundation of its wealth through the armed conquest of land, genocide, slavery, and ruthless exploitation of successive waves of immigrants to America. And it has continued as a country marked by white supremacy, patriarchy and male supremacy, and other oppressive divisions, while expanding its domination into an empire stretching across the globe, sitting atop a lopsided world of profound inequalities and plunder of the environment. It would take the resources of nearly five Earths for the rest of the world to have the kind of consumer society that exists in the US. All this backed up and enforced by a massive machinery of death and devastation, the US military, and reinforced with a constant barrage of ideas and culture rationalizing and justifying all this oppression and destruction, propagated through an equally massive machinery of molding public opinion. Today, while the U.S. is, and loudly proclaims itself to be, the world's number one superpower, it is riddled with sharpening contradictions and facing growing challenges within the country and internationally. And this has brought forth a fascist regime that now holds the reins of power with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. The truth, another terrible truth that must be faced, is that in the context of profound and acute contradictions that are asserting or reasserting themselves in ways that are tearing at the very fabric and deepening cracks in the foundation of this country, at the same time as the American empire is facing serious challenges internationally. Fascism is one possible resolution of this, on the terms of this system and its ruling class, even as this is a horror for humanity. While the Constitution does establish the separation of church and state, and the Christian fascists are wrong or simply lying when they insist that the founding documents of this country established it as a Christian nation, the reality is that Christianity has all along been the unofficial state religion of this country, and the country's identity throughout its history has been as a white Christian nation, grounded in male supremacy as well as white supremacy, and driven by a manifest destiny to dominate not only the continent of North America, but ultimately the world as a whole. All this has been brought into question and has become the focus of intense struggle going back to the 1960s, and in some important ways, back to the Civil War. And while developments internationally, including the demise of the Soviet Union, have given further impetus to the globalization of the capitalist world economy, this very heightened globalization has propelled changes that have sharpened contradictions within the U.S. as well as on a world level, particularly with an emerging capitalist China mounting a challenge to U.S. global economic dominance. At the same time as this heightened globalization, under conditions of Western imperialist domination, has wreaked havoc in countries throughout the Third World, including the Middle East and other places where Islam is the prevailing religion, adding fuel to a virulent Islamic fundamentalism that has declared war on the decadent West and on infidels and others oriented toward the West and facilitating its imperial domination. In order to bring about any positive resolution to all this, even short of abolishing and moving beyond this whole system, it is necessary and crucial to break with the normal routine and the normal workings of the political process.
That was Bob Avakian from the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. You can see the entire film, plus hours of Q&A and much more at revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Her name is Regattas Appling, and she's a lawyer, and she, basically what happened is I came across an article that she had written that really sort of knocked me back. I thought it's something that too many people aren't talking about, and a whole lot of people need to be talking about, and it's what's happening to oppressed nationalities, Black and Latino. This is especially related to New York City, but it's also something that if you live anywhere in this country, you know what is being talked about. And I'm really pleased to welcome her to the show. Regattas, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be here and talking about racist policing, essentially, across America, which has always been happening, but is definitely something that we really have to pay attention to during these pandemics.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really important, the recognition of the fact that police from the very beginning have been, the job they have is to protect the property and the wealth of the people that run the society. And a big part of that, what that means, is to really slam down on kill, murder, destroy the lives of people, and especially people of color over the centuries. It's something that too many people can talk about and say, you know, oh yeah, that's true, but, you know, it's sort of like it just goes away.
Well, it doesn't, because I'm a public defender in New York City, and every day at my job, I see the effects of policing, and it's directly has to do with racism, biased policing, and all of the broken windows policies, all of the policies that are in place right now really just police poverty and also police Black neighborhoods, Latin neighborhoods.
One of the things that you say that I thought was really important, and I think it really helped to sort of orient anyone who's reading the piece that you wrote, when you're talking about this and you talk about there are actions that were done by the mayor and the governor of New York, they made a lot of pleas for the people of New York to adhere to actions that will help stop the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic in New York City. And you point out that the New York City cops are the one organization that were the ones that didn't have to pay any attention to that. They were actually encouraged to carry on with business as usual, which is a pretty dirty business.
Absolutely. The police commissioner said that they wouldn't slow down. They weren't going to stop their operations, even though there's this pandemic going on where so many people are told to stay home, stay in place, not move around. And the police are actually out there just carrying on with arrests to the extent that would actually kind of shock people, going to people's houses on old warrants and arresting them, to stopping and just basically arresting homeless people. And this is the kind of thing that simply spreads disease. A lot of them were not wearing masks. They were not social distancing at all, as we can see in that video with the young child who they were aggressively stopping for selling candy on the train.
You talk a lot about selective policing and that's a constant no matter what. And that's what I think you're getting at now. And I'd like to continue along that a little bit.
Yes. Well, I mean, a very egregious example was the there was a funeral in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, of a Hasidic rabbi. And this was sanctioned and allowed by the police and by the mayor. They actually supplied officers to be there and to set up barriers. And there were hundreds of people, not at all social distancing, in fact, crowded in the streets of Williamsburg during this funeral procession where the police are there, just not arresting people, not aggressively policing them. In fact, sort of like barricading and guiding off and helping out in this apparently city-sanctioned funeral. And this is egregious considering there's so many people here in New York that are dying without their family members, and not just in New York, around the world. They're dying alone in hospitals, not allowed to see family, and the family doesn't even know where their bodies are half the time. I've seen freezers outside of hospitals, you know, the big freezers where they're just putting dead bodies, and no one's being able to even say goodbye to their loved ones, much less gather. And to gather in such an enormous size with the police just basically sanctioning it. Now, if this exact same sort of procession or even a smaller gathering were to happen, let's say in Bed-Stuy or in Brownsville or in Flatbush, you can guarantee that the police would use tear gas, bullets, everything to disrupt a crowd at a funeral. And we know that because they would use these sort of aggressive tactics on a child, or as I had in the article, on an elderly man in San Diego. So it's just discriminatory, it's racist, and it's extra aggressive policing in Black and brown neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things that really drew me to the article that you wrote, it really just pounded on my head, because you make this point about the example of what happened to a very young Black child who was, get ready for this, folks, criminal activity, selling candy on a subway platform. You know, and it was very helpful to have the video of that, because when you looked at that and you saw this little guy, this little kid, who's, you know, and they were treating him like he was sort of a runaway animal or they're going to pull him off, throw him in jail. I mean, it was horrendous what they were doing. And the kid's mother and I guess other siblings were there, and there was nothing they could do, you know, but the kid is just, I mean, he's, you can see petrified and has no idea what the hell is going to happen to him. And the idea, it reminded me of what was going on in this country under slavery. When you look at what happened to this young kid and to his parents, his mother, who could just stand there and, you know, she could cry, she could say, no, but the cops were basically, tough luck, lady.
Yeah. And yes, it's directly from slavery to the patrols. That's where the police came from, right? These slave patrols, to Jim Crow, to the chain gangs, all of it is a direct link to policing black bodies. And the fact that we're not shocked that this would happen to a child on the subway, and the fact that we can all watch it and the people watching it are saying, you know, oh, he's a kid, let him go. But of course, no one actually intervenes because we're so used to the police brutalizing us, and we know that if someone actually intervenes, that could be their life. And it's a direct correlation, you're right, to really reminds us of the history and the present.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Rigatus Appling, who's a lawyer in New York City and has written a really powerful article on the social distancing doesn't matter when it comes to racist aggressive policing. And if you're black, you could very likely end up on a slab. Now, let me ask you this. It's clear to anybody who lives in this country, I think, it's not clear to anybody who lives in this country, but anybody who has their eyes open and has a sense of reality and a sense of, you know, standing with people.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, surprised. But this is not an isolated incident. And that's the thing that really gets me, too, is that this is more a reflection of how people of color are treated by the New York Police Department, and not just them, but cops of every part of the spectrum everywhere in the country.
Yes, daily. And as a public defender, I see it daily. It's shocking, but then you're also sort of just, okay, reading a complaint, that's what happened. You know, people are arrested for literally things that no white person would ever get arrested for. You know, I once had a complaint where someone was doing like pull-ups on the stop sign, you know, the light sign. They had very New York kind of thing, like grabbing on to the light post and doing pull-ups, and they were arrested and brought into jail for that type of behavior. And this is, it's the little things like that to just about everything that is racist, aggressive policing. And then, you know, there's just obviously the stop and frisk. We're just stopping people for no reason at all, not actually having a pretext to stop them and inspecting them and seeing if they can find anything. And that still goes on today. We still see things like this today. So yes, this is every day in New York City and around America, where if you are a black person, you know, when you see the police, that there's a chance something might happen to you.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things as you were talking, I kept thinking about this too, and it's a thing that I keep coming back to. And, you know, I've written a lot over the years, over the last 30, 40 years of what's happened to people, especially people of color in this country and around the world. And, you know, and it's interesting in some places where, you know, I spent some time in South Africa under apartheid and was writing about what was happening there. And you know, it was the case there, and it was very interesting. You see what was happening there, and then you come back to this country, and it's not a far cry from what was being done in all of these countries against the various people of color. And I found it in South Africa. I found it in further east, and then in the time that I spent traveling around here and writing about everything, you know, for a long time, writing about, it was good that I was writing about it, but, you know, you're coming up against day after day, year after year, you know, all this, the role of the police in society. And the whole idea, you know, because you look at this, it's both current and historical. And, you know, it's basically saying that the lives of black and brown people and other people of color they're taught from the very beginning in this society that their lives don't matter. And the people who are the privileged ones in this society are also taught that the lives of black and brown and other people of color do not matter. You know, and that's something that's trained, ingrained in people. And it's the evil is really, really profound here and continues to grow and develop. And too many people are allowing it to do so.
And it's especially sad at this time of the pandemic where people are losing so many of our loved ones, to have our governments, from obviously Donald Trump to Andrew Cuomo and even de Blasio, supporting the measures of, I think today or yesterday, de Blasio says there's going to be cuts, everything slashed. They're slashing education by billions. They're doing away with summer youth programs. They are doing away with some preschool type of programs. And yet they're keeping the police budget the same. They're continuing with everything that they've continued to do. So when they say that we're all in this together and, you know, this is affecting everyone and the budget cuts are going to be massive, they're not apparently massive to the police department, which in my view are not essential. We do not need this type of policing. We don't need this much policing. And we don't need to give the police this huge budget for what, you know, and that we know that their purpose has been and is to just essentially police black bodies. And it's been going on, and we can actually lay the blame right now during this extreme time at the feet of our government, of our local government, of our mayor and of our governor. And we can ask them, why are they doing this?
And, you know, even more, I think what we need to ask is, you know, ask the people who can watch that video, ask the people who can see what's happening in the prisons, ask the people that can see, just to open their eyes and look at what's happening to people of color and other oppressed nationalities and whatnot in this country and around the world. Tell me how you can justify that, because I don't think any real human being could not justify this. And I think it's an absolute crime that people are standing by and allowing this to happen.
Absolutely. And if they don't care even about, let's say, other people, other communities, they should at least care about themselves, because prisons are going to spread this disease. We've seen that, right? We've seen that the main hotbed in New York of COVID is the prison. It has the most concentrated number of COVID cases in the entire U.S. is Rikers.
All right. We've come up on our time, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Sure. And keep writing, and I'll keep following it, okay?
Okay, great. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care now.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Some man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to? All along that day, you gonna run to the sea, but the sea will be boiling when you run to the sea. The sea will be boiling when you run to the sea. The sea will be boiling all along that day. You're gonna run to the rocks.
Welcome back. Joining us now is Dr. Jesse Kimbrough Marshall, a public health doctor and medical doctor in Detroit, Michigan, who has been studying and digging into the danger to African Americans from the novel coronavirus. Jesse, Dr. Jesse Kimbrough Marshall. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. I'm really excited about talking with you about this because I think it's one of the really important questions right now that's going on in the society overall. And I was basically thinking of this as I read some of the stuff that you wrote a very moving letter, actually, about your basically what you're seeing happening in the world today and how to look at it. And I thought it was really important for people to know that and what you're doing. And you recently wrote this letter to political and social leaders in Detroit, posing a question that demands an answer. You say that everything is on fire, but the fire in the Black community is totally out of control. What's that mean in reality?
The rampant racial disparities that we're seeing in Detroit, as well in other parts of the state and the country, involving communities of color, particularly Black communities, from this pandemic, this COVID-19 disease causing or actually magnifying racial disparities in very dramatic terms.
Tell me this, you talk about when you talk about these disparities, what actually are they?
As it relates to COVID-19, deaths, complications from COVID-19. What we're seeing is that this virus, the coronavirus, is very, very contagious, and it appears, based off of statistics anyways, that African Americans are having disproportionate rates of infection and death from this virus.
You know, and it's part of when I read your work, one of the things that happens is I think about this, you pose a very big question that you're speaking to now a little bit, but you pose this question that really has to be answered. And I was really pleased with the fact that it came up just bright and early, right in the forefront of the thing, where you talk about that there are questions that must be answered and soon, and those questions are, how can we stop the coronavirus from taking more Black lives? There's already a lot of Black people who are suffering under this disease, under this whole, what's happening here. And how can we stop this thing? What are the kinds of things that you're thinking about when you're looking at all the Black lives that have been taken, and then you're looking at knowing that it has this, you know, just, it, and I recognize the thing doesn't have a will since it's not human, but it does have a real power in the world right now in terms of what's being posed for so many people, and oftentimes so many people being, and especially in this one, being the people in the very bottom of this society.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about this virus is that it does not discriminate on who it will infect. However, what we are seeing based off of local and state public health departments across the country is that there are some communities that have more exposure to the virus. And that's what we're seeing with a good number of Blacks in this country. Blacks are disproportionately affected by chronic diseases like diabetes, asthma, high blood pressure, and also overrepresented in a lower socioeconomic status group or class, if you will. And that's not by that's not a coincidence. There have been innumerable historical racial insults and injustices that have set the stage up for what we're seeing. And so when you take a pandemic that comes through not discriminating, affecting anyone it can, those who are most vulnerable, those who are working these essential jobs on the front line, they have increased exposure and therefore increased opportunity to become infected. And with underlying medical problems like diabetes, high blood pressure, once infected, the disease can potentially be quite devastating in its complications.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, you know, it's important that you point out in the same letter that there's also an importance to recognizing that present-day racial disparities and relentlessly savage assaults on the lives of black people in America are rooted in the whole way that this system is formed. And it's, you know, back then and now. And let's dig into that a little bit, because I think it's really important. It has something to do, and I think you're onto something when you're pointing that out, that this is not just an accident of history. It's just not, it's not just sort of, oops, we didn't realize we were doing all this to black people. But this is rooted in something that's been going on since the beginning of this country, and even before that in other places around the world. Let's talk about that, the historical reality of this.
Right, yeah, thank you. So I call that changing the narrative. And what I mean by that is to say it's important to, as we look at the disparities that we see, it's important to understand what those root causes are. I recall when I was younger, I would wonder, well, how come black folks are, how come we're getting high rates of this and high rates of that? And it wasn't clear. And I thought something was, got more advanced in my studies, that I came to understand that if you see a flower, if you have a garden and flowers are not developing to their full potential, do you just destroy the flowers, or do you change the environment of those flowers? Do you change the soil from which those flowers are growing? And so that's really an analogy that I use when I'm looking at the disparities that we see with a lot of people of color, particularly African Americans, here in this country. So when we talk about historical insults based off of race and structural inequalities, we could really go back to any point in time since enslaved Africans were brought over here to the United States. But if we want to keep it in more modern times, let's look back during World War II, when the creation of the GI Bill and the new American dream being owning a home and building wealth by owning that home. And we know that there were policies put in place. They were government sanctioned, carried out by the banking industry, where there was redlining for blacks and for some other ethnic groups, where loans weren't offered. There was exclusion from certain areas. And what that really set the stage up for was wealth inequality. At that time and moving into present day, the way the average American built wealth was through home ownership. And with the home ownership, you built equity. And that's how you could fund your children's education. That's how you could prepare for your retirement. So that if you were in suburbia and you have this home, you know, these things could occur. But if you were excluded from that in living in areas that were divested, neglected, that opportunity to build up equity in your home did not exist. And that opportunity to build up wealth to pass down generation for generation also did not persist, and really helped to solidify the racial wealth gaps that we see. We can also look in almost any aspect of life in society and trace roots of structural inequities. We can look at the prison industrial complex. In the mid 70s, there seemed to be a rise in the U.S. prison population, and certainly with the passage of the crime bill in the mid 90s, it skyrocketed much, much further. And one would say, wow, what was that rise and that spike all about? Well, in the late 70s, going up into the 80s, 90s, and so forth, there was a crack cocaine epidemic largely affecting the black community across the United States in urban areas and some rural, southern rural areas. And unlike with the opioid epidemic, which there's a gentler hand in trying to deal with those who are affected, the way the crack cocaine epidemic was handled was lock everybody up. And when you look at crack cocaine and cocaine sentencing disparities, having 28 grams of crack cocaine would get you a sentencing of 5 years, but it would take 500 grams of cocaine to get you that same sentencing. We know that with the crack cocaine epidemic affecting largely Blacks, that those most likely to have crack cocaine were Black folks, and those likely to have the powder cocaine, the more pure cocaine, were white folks. And so if you're getting a much stiffer sentencing with smaller amounts of a drug that's more prevalent in your community, well, that's a structural inequity that's going to result in more imprisoned people with the stiffer sentencing. And so we can also, my home state of Michigan, talk about the Flint water crisis and the environmental injustice that happened there to a city that is economically deficient, and what was able to happen there, and the poisoning of water just is a unfortunate story that we have seen before in terms of environmental injustice. And I could just go on and on and on and on, but the bottom line is that if it's expected for individuals, for people to make responsible personal choices, then society has to provide responsible societal options by way of those social determinants of health. Because, you know, President Ronald Reagan used to say, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. But if you don't have boots, how are you going to pull yourself up? And so if we have communities across this country that have been divested and neglected, what exactly do we expect of them?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you say, too, and it really kind of struck me hard, was you say everything is on fire, but the fire in the Black community is out of control. And I don't think that enough people actually understand, one, that that's true, but also what does it mean?
So what I meant by everything was on fire, and this was about 2-3 weeks ago, I think, the pandemic here in the United States, particularly in the Midwest and Northeast of the country, were being slammed, if you will, with this virus. The schools, the K-12 schools shutting down, college campuses shutting down, just things that we have never seen before in our lifetime. And businesses shutting down and orders to stay in at home. That's what I like it to. Everything is on fire. Our world is so dramatically flipped up over its head because of the seriousness of what was going on. And as deaths started to be reported across the board, irrespective of race, I would turn on the news and just see how the virus, this pandemic, was affecting so many communities, particularly New York, the city of New York. And I was just like taken aback. But as some days passed and racial data was starting to be released, the marked disparities, the marked differences in the rates of death from this virus causing disease were breathtaking. In my state of Michigan, Blacks are 14% of the population, but yet was representing 32% of infections and 40% of deaths. And the city of Detroit, we're 7% of the state of Michigan population, but yet 23% of deaths. And you could look and see similar stories in other large urban areas like Chicago, where Blacks are about a third of the population for that city, but was representing like up to 70% of the deaths. And while I have studied racial and ethnic health disparities for some time, I had never in my lifetime seen such dramatic rates of death by race in such a short period of time. And also during this time, I was seeing a lot of local leaders and local celebrities who also were Black and dying. And it was overwhelming. It was very, very overwhelming. Dealing with the pandemic in and of itself left so much uncertainty, but to see how ferocious it was to Black communities across the country was just really heartbreaking, so incredibly heartbreaking, and so unnecessary, so unnecessary, because health disparities are avoidable. They are absolutely avoidable and preventable. But if you're living in a society that has divested and neglected certain communities, this is what you see. You can look at other man-made or natural disasters and see a similar tale. I think of Hurricane Katrina and who was most affected in terms of bad outcomes and deaths, and what happened to be their socioeconomic status, what happened to be their race in terms of who was most affected. And again, it's the same story. It was the Blacks in that area who were disproportionately low income, who were disproportionately in areas of the city of New Orleans, which were much more at risk for the effects of being flooded. And it, again, it's just the same old story, but in such a dramatic sense that it was really overwhelming. And that's why I likened it to everything is on fire, but it's totally out of control in the Black community across the country.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we are talking with Dr. Jesse Kimbrough Marshall.
You know, it's very heavy, because when I'm listening to you, and I keep thinking again that, you know, that this point about everything's on fire, but the fire in the Black communities out of control is a lot of, you know, there's a way that can be posed as like, people are just like, people are standing up and rising up and doing all this. And would that they were, you know, in terms of, and even able to even function in that level at this point. But it's actually what you're talking about. What's actually being done is that what's out of control is actually the whole way that the system has come down on Black people in particular, and Latino people, but, you know, come down on them, and they're faced so that they're facing an actual onslaught that has genocidal implications. And people don't really speak to that very much. It's increasingly, this is more than just implications too.
Yeah. I remember some years ago when I was in grad school, hearing the analogy of the canary and the coal mine. And I was so fascinated when I first heard this analogy with coal miners taking a canary bird down in the coal mine. And if the canary, while they were working, if they noticed that the canary seemed to be disrupted, seemed to be not well, and in fact, maybe he died, that was a signal to them that the gases that were not readily noticeable for them was becoming at such high levels that it would harm them. And the most vulnerable in the community was affected first, that small bird, that canary. And so that canary dying or becoming unwell was the call for them to evacuate from that coal mine. And so I liken that to society and populations like Black and brown people, who again are disproportionately in lower socioeconomic groups and in communities that are not resourced. When we see issues with income inequality, which as Americans we've become quite used to seeing certain groups be overrepresented, and then when you look at chronic diseases, we have become quite used to again seeing certain groups overrepresented, dying early in disproportionate numbers. If we take a step back and look and get out of the trees and look at the forest, what we would find is that the more vulnerable groups are being affected disproportionately, but everybody is being affected. And if things don't improve, don't correct themselves, then while we see the most dramatic impact happening on those vulnerable communities, it eventually will affect these other more resourced communities that have enjoyed investment and a privilege. And so we can keep our eyes on the South as we see governors lifting the stay-at-home orders and whatnot. I mean, I hate to even think about what might happen, what is projected to happen by some scientific models, but the South in some areas are not prepared in terms of having hospitals and ventilators to take in a surge of patients who are sick and who may be dying from COVID-19. And with that being said, that will not just affect Black folks, that's going to affect anybody who are living in these areas, particularly those of lower socioeconomic status, irrespective of race. We may initially see it among people of color in these areas, but it's likely going to be devastating to many folks down in that area.
Yeah, you know, there's a real need for, I think, people who are in these areas, and there's also a real need for people who are outside of these areas. Like, if you're sitting here in this society and you're, like, if you're sitting here in this society and you're looking at, if you're watching the television or you're just reading the newspaper or you're hearing things from friends and family or whatever, and you're understanding that there's a huge, there's really a crime against humanity that's being perpetrated right now. And there's, it seems to me that, like, if you think about that, you think about, you know, maybe if you sort of fall back on some of the various, you know, just monsters of history that have been put before us over and over and over again. And people used to say, well, it can't happen here. And then you look at this and you say, it seems to be happening here.
Yeah. So what I would say to that is, once you know more, once you become enlightened to problems, you have some options. You can ignore what you're seeing and carry on, or you can work to help to solve those problems. And so what COVID-19, what this pandemic has done was to just very dramatically highlight racial disparities. This pandemic did not create structural inequality or inequities. It simply is having a much more harsh effect on communities that have been affected by structural inequalities. And so what I find when I'm giving lectures to communities or in academic settings is that there are a lot of folks out there, including people of color and not, who are not aware of the structural inequalities and inequities that have existed and continue to exist, leading to the disparities in health that we see. And so once folks are made aware of these disparities and also come to understand the root causes of what we see, again, you have a choice. You can stay in, you know, your bubble of comfort, if you will, and privilege, or you can come out of that to see what you can do to help so that all of humanity has the opportunity for the pursuit of good health and longevity.
You know what? And we're going to have to wrap this up real quick, but I just got to add one thing, which is that, you know, there's something that I think you had written in the bottom of your, at the end of your letter, and you said, the time is now for our village to come together and stop the deaths of Black lives because we matter. And I think it's because humanity itself, I think that's an important thing. And I think extended to what you've been talking about now is that humanity itself is up against something that we better recognize and stand up and stop. So that's, and it's more than just, it's more that we have a fascist in the White House. We have all this stuff going on. And people cannot relax and sit back and allow any of these horrors to go unnoticed or unfought. So I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
All right. All right, Jesse Kimbrough Marshall, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, Jesse, take care. Bye. We have just been talking with Dr. Jesse Kimbrough Marshall, a public health doctor and medical doctor in Detroit, Michigan, who has been studying and digging into the danger to African Americans from the novel coronavirus. Once again, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I want to thank all of my guests today and each and every one of you. If you want to write to me about ideas or comments you have around the show, please do. Send your ideas and comments to mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, oh, oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children to jump the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long judgment day, so won't you make them happy before they pass away. Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Just let it be. No, 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 no. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.